Hey everyone, in honor of the release of the new Ghostbusters Afterlife, we are releasing from behind the vault doors the last, I guess, canonical Ghostbusters, Ghostbusters 2. This is a formerly original release, then Patreon exclusive. If you want to hear the rest of the back catalog, of course, go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/myopia, and you can get access to it at a very low level. Just check out the tiers. There's extra episodes, there's all sorts of stuff. Thanks, guys.
So, Zach, how you doing?
Doing pretty good.
So today we're going to watch Ghostbusters 2. What made you think Ghostbusters 2 there, buddy?
I love the ending of the movie. I like the fact they have the Statue of Liberty come alive. And all the New Yorkers come out and celebrate, which is funny because they're kind of making fun of New Yorkers in that entire movie. That's kind of what I remember from it.
Yeah, no, it's interesting you bring that up because the first one is that the whole part of the movie, the whole point of the, as I remember the first one, it's they have this crazy idea and it turns out that they're right. So they in the end are justified. In the second one, for some reason, I don't remember much, but I remember them losing all of that respectability, even though they saved the world, and then having to build it back up again, followed by the Statue of Liberty saving the day, kind of.
I don't remember. I do remember they lose all respect. I don't remember how. And I know they get thrown either in jail or in a psycho institute in the second one. And I kind of like the second one because it's not really supposed to be a comedy, but it kind of is because it's kind of self-making fun of itself.
You know what? I think that's something we might have to get back to because, you know what? I think you're right. It's been forever since I've seen the second one, but I remember the first one really being a comedy and then the second one really not being a comedy, and I don't remember why.
Well, the funny thing is I don't think it was supposed to be a comedy. I think it was supposed to be a very, like, serious and melodramatic film because they have that weird, crazy guy and that those strange artists, but for some reason, the way they did it is so over the top, it's just absolutely hysterical.
And the other thing I think is interesting, the first movie I remember, they really set up this idea of, I don't want to say science versus magic, but that these spirits are so real that in fact science can overcome them and control them.
Yeah.
But the second one, I remember that emotion plays a big part of it and like how rooms feel and like emotion sludge, maybe?
Yeah, there's that weird emo sludge thing that just is kind of like strange, and then you have this entire thing of one of the characters trying to balance his romance life with his ghost busting life, and it's like, it's just like really strange.
And see, when I was a kid and I saw this movie, and I have a feeling I've brought this up to you before, I saw them back to back because they both came out when I was so young, I wouldn't know them. So it was the kind of thing that we rented when we had a babysitter or something and we watched them together. So I remember liking both movies a lot,
yeah.
But thinking about it, I only remember anything about the first one, really. And so the second one might be a secret terrible movie. I don't know.
The only thing I ever remembered about the second movie is the Statue of Liberty. And if I hadn't seen, like, the last third and the last couple, like, last month, I wouldn't have remembered anything about the movie.
So, other than the climax, two-thirds of this movie is a complete mystery to you.
Pretty much, yeah.
And go on.
The weird thing is I actually remember the cartoon series that came out after both these movies.
Yeah.
And that was fantastic. And I don't know why that cartoon series went away. I wished they could bring it back as kind of a retro thing because it was absolutely fantastic.
So what you're saying is that the animated series really is the sequel that we have all wanted for a decade.
Pretty much. I actually am thinking of downloading it now that I'm talking about it.
It might be on Netflix actually. So anyway, let's leave it here and watch Ghostbusters 2.
Show. I had a throwing party for a bunch of children while all the wild slime was under the building. So they packed up
Hi, this is Nick Hoffman. Welcome to Myopia Defend Your Childhood. Today we are watching 1989's Ghostbusters 2, a sequel to a movie that should have come out 3 years earlier, but no one cared to tell them to do it. I'm sitting around the table. I'm Nick Hoffman, editor-in-chief of Dude Letter.
Aaron, hi.
I'm Scott.
Steve-o. Daniel.
Zach.
And we're trying to figure out, if Dan Aykroyd was even thinking at all, B, what Ivan Reichman was thinking giving them the money to do this, and C, if anyone bothered to tell Harold Ramis he was on camera. So, we'll start with you, Mr. Krause.
Originally, before I watched the movie, I thought it was a great movie. I think I have to take a step back here and reanalyze that. The end of the movie was fantastic. I actually think it was better than the first Ghostbusters.
Well, we'll get to this, but where exactly in the Statue of Liberty do you plug in a Nintendo Power controller to make her walk down Broadway or wherever they were supposed to be going?
Truthfully, I don't really care if that's completely unrealistic. As a young man,
as a young man
who played Nintendo as a little boy, that scene is fantastic. I wish I could do that in real life.
You literally grew up hoping you could control the Statue of Liberty with your power glove. Is that what we're saying here?
That would be fantastic.
Wait, Scott, you mean you can't?
I actually don't know. I've never tried. Never owned a power
glove. But only
glove.
If you spray her with your good slime. The happy slime.
Wow. 30 seconds, we're off the rails. Good job.
Well, considering that even in the first one they had to put the nozzle of the gun about crotch level to fire it, the fact that they're spraying goo on things to make them happy.
Really got it. Yeah.
I really don't think they had enough slime jokes in that particular scene, but anyway.
Well, yeah, and the end of the first one ends with covering someone with some goo as well, as I recall, after the Marshmallow Man explodes, so...
Ghosts are nothing but ectoplasm, so it's all going to go back to goo and slime and such.
And this episode, sponsored by Dan Aykroyd's Skull Tequila, reminding you that sometimes slime is what helps you forget. So, let's try to get through a little bit of the plot of this movie. Now, it's been a while since I've seen Ghostbusters 1, but I love Ghostbusters. I think it's one of the, probably the best comedies of the last 30 years. God, almost 40 years now.
It's exactly 30 years old today.
Yeah.
30 years. And I think they're re-releasing it in It's exactly one Zach in age. So that, my God. Could you have been conceived during Ghostbusters?
It's a possibility.
Ectoplasm.
You would explain it.
Yeah.
the first one is a classic. I think we can all agree on that. And the question here, though, is whether the second one holds up. When I was a kid, and I mentioned this in the intro, I watched them both back to back because they were on video. It was the kind of thing, just like Batman and Batman Returns, you could rent them both. You could watch them in a long evening with the babysitter. That was it, you know. I don't remember anything about this one until we saw it, and I now think I realize why.
The weird thing is in the 80s when I saw this movie, I definitely remembered it, and I really liked it a lot. Now, I don't know why, maybe it's because I've gotten older, I don't like the beginning of the movie at all. It is so slow, and it takes them 20 minutes to introduce the actual ghost. Which I thought was kind
of
strange.
There's a lot of unnecessary exposition that they created themselves. Like, Dana and Venkman didn't really work out, and she went and married some dude and had a baby. But now they're kind of back into each other. So we have this weird plot that shouldn't have happened.
You know, the weird thing about that opening is, watching it now, it's like, this is a Woody Allen movie, or this is some Merchant Ivory drama production. I mean, it didn't say madcap comedy at all, which is what made the first one so great. I mean, the opening of the first one, wasn't that the scene in the library with the...
very iconic scene to open that movie.
There you go. This one, they have a puddle of pink slime seeping up from the sidewalk, which is just...
In a runaway, possessed baby carriage that dodges cars and kind of ends on a blah note.
I'm pretty sure New Yorkers would just refer to that as Wednesday.
Yeah. It's Baby's Day Out. It's the 1980s.
Oh, sorry.
No.
The, Okay. So the best part about the intro, I thought, was the fact that they have the theme song, and then 2 minutes later, the actors are singing and dancing to the theme song at a birthday party.
That this movie decided to be meta at some point. Yeah. That theme song is in the universe. It's in the Ghostbusters universe now. It is not the theme song to the movie. It is a theme song to them themselves, which, and they know all the words.
Which means
they don't use it in any of their commercials at all, even though it's obviously...
Yeah, their low-budget commercials cannot afford the royalties.
Which means at some point they hired Ray Parker Jr. as the Ghostbusters to write them a theme song, or he made a hit independent of them, and in some sort of class-action lawsuit, they won the rights to play it without his permission.
Well, it's the 80s. They don't have protest songs anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, down with Reagan. Let's play Ghostbusters.
I believe the MST3K guys summed up the 1980s the best. It's the 80s. Do a lot of coke and vote for Ronald Reagan.
I think that's our first musical cue in a long time.
Continuing with the music, they seem to add like weird musical intros and scenes that made absolutely no sense at all. Like, I don't know if they were paid a lot of money just to put in some random 80s song, but that's kind of what it felt like.
Well, and what's worse is these weren't real songs. These were songs that, for the most part, seemed like they were written for the movie, with a few exceptions. Oh, and I think Scotty Boy pointed this out. There was about 40 minutes there where there was no music at all.
This movie did something that I hate in comedies, because comedies you're expecting, like, oh, it's okay, I'm going to laugh in a couple of minutes, is... dialogue's happening, things are happening, but there's no music, there's no score, there's really no sound effect. It's just dialogue. And if it's not funny, you're sitting there kind of just looking around the room being like, is anyone else uncomfortable right now? And that happened probably the first 20 minutes. That 20 minutes we were saying, it just took a long time to get going. It was just suffering from that. And then the music started coming back in a little bit. Action started happening a little bit, Ghostbusters theme, and then you're like, alright, now the movie's picking up again. Like, they had this weird, I don't know if they're just, like, improvising and they couldn't plan it, so...
Well, I think Zach brought this up in his intro. It's not a comedy, for the most part. You know, like, there's essentially two movies going on. One is a rom-com between, you know, it's a man baby and a baby, and Sigourney Weaver fresh off of Alien.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's the Three Stooges discover slime underneath New York. Yeah. But it's not funny. Like, there's no jokes, as opposed to the first one, which seems like at times it was almost overwritten. You know, you said Bill Murray in the first one seemed like he was kind of an ass.
Oh, he was.
But in the
Bill Murray, great. Kind of an ass. I don't
well,
mind.
I mean, yeah. But he was fantastic in the movie. He, like, it was a score, a home run, even though he's an ass.
But the second one, he was the only one making jokes, and it seemed like he was improvising those jokes because no one else was like, except for Rick Moranis, who is spectacular. He's a treasure of Canada.
I actually forgot he was in this movie before we watched it again, and he's all over this movie, like. Legitimate role.
Rick Moranis and that scene with the lady, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
For our listeners out there, who wants to explain that one?
Are you referring to Annie Potts, the receptionist?
Oh, God, yeah. She's actually pretty hot, by the way.
They try and hook up about halfway through the movie when they're supposed to be babysitting, and this is after a bedtime story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, where Rick Moranis is talking about... the dwarves' tax plan or whatever.
And this is a perfect example of what we're talking about. We just described a scene from the Ghostbusters movie. Yes.
This was the thing that happened.
About babysitting and Snow White as in tax world. This all happened.
And then he comes out and she basically asks him to make her a baby.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, that's pretty much what she says. I was like, that's fantastic, but why is that in this movie?
That's fantastic. Well,
that was well put, I think, because that's what it is. There's no point to the scene. In fact, the scene only reminds us that ghosts only happen when you're not looking, apparently, because the baby becomes sentient and walks out to the ledge, but we don't see any of it.
Can I actually jump into a little earlier?
Please.
One of the weirdest things to me about this movie was how everybody, all the characters, everyone in the city, everyone seemed to forgot that the first movie happened.
Yes.
So, oh my God, that's so true.
We need to start here.
They had to prove that ghosts actually existed. It's like, you've already seen a Godzilla-sized marshmallow being wandering throughout your city, and you need proof that these guys know what they're talking about?
So part of that weird exposition that makes no sense to me at the beginning of the movie is not just Venkman and Dana's thing, it's that the Ghostbusters got no credibility or love after the whole Zool and Stay Puft Marshmallow Man incident. Instead, they were banned from ever being Ghostbusters, essentially, ever again.
And sued, too.
Yeah, it's sued by the city.
It's never explained what they were sued for. They just said they were sued by a lot of people.
May I remind the court that the defendants are under a judicial restraining order that strictly forbids them from performing services as paranormal investigators or eliminators.
So noted.
Well, and in fact, they even make the point that the city stiffed them on paying them. And it's a weird turn for a sequel, because usually the sequel is the same movie with the somehow the stakes raised, right? You know, it's Alien has one alien, Aliens has a herd of them, and there's a bunch of Marines. Ooh. Mighty Ducks go from taking over Chicagoland to taking over the entire world.
Mighty Ducks.
Well, what else would you go? It's not.
Yeah, fair enough.
It just feels like
Blues Brothers 2000 went to saving the millennium from the Y2K virus. It's.
I thought Blues Brothers 2000 was about kidnapping a child, but all right.
And then at the end, the child kidnaps them back, and it's heartwarming scene.
That's right.
It just feels like this movie is not a normal sequel, which is maybe why people say it's the worst sequel ever, but I don't know if that's completely true.
I don't know if people are really saying
it. It was a CG. It was a cash grab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to jump in here there, speaking about that. I've heard people say this is one of the worst sequels of all time, but watching Dan, okay, it's not as good as the first one, but there's been a far worse sequels. I just think the biggest thing about this one is it's almost inoffensive. It's like you watch it, you completely forget what it's about and what happened in it. It might as well not exist.
Well, and it's disappointing because the first one is a classic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely.
That's what I was going to say was that, you know, I think this movie suffers from the fact that it is being compared to something that is pretty iconic, that has some pretty iconic lines that everybody would recognize. I think if it just stood on its own, one, that would solve some of the amnesia problems, actually, that everyone was suffering. That would kind of take care of that. I think it's maybe a B-rate movie, but it comes across as a C-rate movie because of what it's up against.
So you're saying it suffers from Godfather 3 syndrome, which is that it'd be a fine movie on its own, but the first two were so strong. And the other problem that frustrates me, all the characters seem to reboot. Mm-hmm. You know, you leave the end of the first one where, again, it's Godzilla. Not to bring it down, but we're 14 years after 9/11 and everyone remembers it all the time. If a Marshmallow Man walked through New York and destroyed half the town, you don't forget it 4 years later and then try to arrest the people who saved the day, and they end up destitute. The only thing we see Ernie Hudson doing is going to birthday parties. Everyone else has a job except for Ernie Hudson. Bill Murray
has... Yeah, that's
a whole other... Well, this is a Ghostbusters movie without the fourth Ghostbuster. But
even the Netflix description that we saw describes the group as a trio, which I think I'm
Netflix.
But it'd be
not
like,
cool.
Author, lecturer, and psychic, Milton Englund. Milt, your new book is called The End of the World. Now, can you tell us when it's going to be, or do we have to buy the book?
Bill Murray has his TV show. Dan Aykroyd has a bookstore.
An occult store.
Egon's back doing research.
And talking about the research assistant liking his epididymis. And I looked up what an epididymis is. It's your testicles. It's what connects the vas deferens to the testicle. So, but they really do have useless jobs. And in fact, we talk about an effective psychologist at the beginning, because they were supposed to be psychologists in the first movie. Bill Murray laughs at someone who thinks she was raped by an alien, but actually was just roofied in a hotel bar.
Elaine, now you had another date in mind.
According to my source, the end of the world will be on February 14th in the year 2016.
Valentine's Day. Bummer. Where'd you get your date, Elaine?
I received this information from an alien. As I told my husband, it was in the Paramus Holiday Inn. I was having a drink at the bar, alone, and this alien approached me. He started talking to me. He bought me a drink, and then I think he must have used some kind of a ray or a mind control device because he forced me to follow him to his room. And that's where he told me about the end of the world.
So your alien had a room at the Holiday Inn, Paramus.
And that's how we get redeemed the characters.
I think I was the one who made the joke watching the movie. I hope her extraterrestrial experience didn't involve any anal probing or else we're in trouble.
And then the joke was essentially made. Like, that's what we're dealing with in this movie. So we have a city that's forgotten them.
Wait a minute. Why are they doing birthday parties? They're sitting on a mountain of proprietary Star Trek technology, and they said, you know what? Let's do some birthday parties.
And not only that, they're doing birthday parties for kids who have no idea who they are. They're like, we don't want you here. We want He-Man here. Because Masters of the Universe probably just came out.
Was
He-Man
still on the air in 1989? Does anyone know?
It came out in
88, by the way. Because I remember seeing it when I was 6 years old, by the way.
There you go.
But the problem here is, though, they really, like, again, not only is the world forgotten, but their entire careers change. In fact, as I recall, Sigourney Weaver's character in the first one was a concert cellist, and then she goes to being an art restorer.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yes. That's what she did in the first one.
I know why I'm confused.
In fact, Phil...
She made mention to that in the movie, that she was going to switch back as soon as her baby grew up a bit.
Well, there was that scene earlier where... Bill Murray shows up at her apartment and takes her bass and starts strumming it?
Yeah.
But I mean, like, that's not how careers work. You don't go from being a New York Philharmonic cellist to being an artist.
Yeah, she wasn't an amateur. Anyway.
I wish my career worked that way. There were lots of jobs in the 80s.
Yeah.
That's true.
Ghostbuster.
The economy must have just been better than it is right now. That's all I gotta say.
Well, and
they didn't have any recession in the 80s.
And Rick and... And Rickonomics goes from being an accountant to being an attorney, when that scene clearly should have been Egon trying to talk about the court.
Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the audience, I don't think it's fair to call my clients frauds. Okay, so the blackout was a big problem for everybody, okay? I was stuck in an elevator for 2 hours and I had to make the whole time. But I don't blame them, because one time I turned into a dog and they helped me. Thank you.
I mean... I guess they just needed to reintroduce Rick Moranis somehow.
Yeah, just shove him in there somehow.
And, I mean, Bill Murray should not have been the one to take the stand. You need someone awkward and elbowy, like your Harold Ramis character.
Really? I thought he was like hysterical.
No, he would have been funny, but he should not be the one explaining ectoplasm.
So you were just trying to help out a friend.
Who was frightened.
Who was scared of what was happening to her. There was no evil intended, no malice. Because you live here, when you live in a place and you love it like you do, you don't want nothing bad to happen. What? Because it'll never happen again. It's an isolated incident. It's a one-shot deal.
Objection, Your Honor.
What?
He's leading the witness.
Sustained.
Give me a break. We're both lawyers.
Mr. Tully, you have any questions for this witness? Might have some bearing on this case.
Do I?
No, we've helped them out enough already.
No, Your Honor. Your witness.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Because in the first whole movie, even at the end, he's being sarcastic like it shouldn't have actually been happening, right?
Yeah. You know, the weird thing about the first one is Rick Moranis was the nerdy neighbor. They tried to reintroduce that character with Peter McNichol, and he's just the most unappealing, unfunny, terrible character I've seen in a while. I mean, for those who don't know, he was this Eastern European doctor that Dana worked for and who... wanted to, I don't know, hit on her, but it didn't work out. But anyway, it was just the movie ground to a halt whenever he was on the screen. It was terrible.
So, Aaron, how do you feel about Janusz?
Best name ever.
Janusz Poha.
Janusz Poha. One of my favorite lines, Es Vigo, which is repeated, I believe, 3 or 4 times in the film.
Es Vigo.
Lucky for us.
He's fun.
I don't know why Dana wouldn't give him a shot.
He's fun. You look at him, and you look at Rick Moranis, and they're trying to play a silly character, as opposed to all of the Ghostbusters kind of just cruise-controlling through the whole thing. And, like, they're just like, oh, my God.
No, it's amazing how funny people can be unfunny and how that grinds the movie to a halt. Because Peter McNichol had a frustrating character, but he was selling that horrible character. Yeah. I mean, he says, thank me, Lord, on his knees at least twice, and that's probably the funniest thing to that point in the movie, until, again, Rick Moranis starts macking with Pepper Potts on the couch.
Listen to me.
What? Who?
I, Vigo, the scourge of Carpathia, the sorrow of Moldavia, command you.
Oh, command me, Lord.
On a mountain of skulls in the castle of pain, I sat on a throne of blood. What was will be, what is will be no more. Now is the season of evil.
Evil?
Find me a child that I might live again.
Yes, a child. A child. A child? Oh. A child.
I'm just wondering how much they paid him to put on the Mary Poppins dragon star baby way.
It was his idea. He showed up.
Oh, he just showed up.
He showed up to filming one day.
Yeah, that's what you're going to look like today. All right, well, we'll write that in somehow. We're doing this all on the fly.
Oh, my God. Regular Marlon Brando, that's isn't he?
Yeah, real method Mary Poppins is what he was doing.
All right, Zach. Beforehand, you really liked this movie. Now you watched it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. That kind of answers it. What do you like it? Do you like parts of it? Do you think it's terrible? What do you think?
This is one of those movies that if I had to watch it again, I would literally skip to pretty much the last 20 minutes and forget the rest of the movie.
Well, like an hour into it, you were like, how much time is left? We're like 50 minutes. And you just said, oy vey.
No, I mean, it was.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And at one point, we were trying to figure out, I think it was the first time we get introduced to something. The ghost. The first time they start ghost busting. Yeah. Actual,
it's like an hour in the movie.
It really is. I think it was 43
minutes.
Yeah, and you're just, it's stunning how, at the first one, they established this incredible concept. It was very well defined for a fantasy movie. Like, they made it very clear the rules of this universe. And then all of a sudden, poof, it's gone, and they have to reestablish everything. It's frustrating. Anyway, we haven't even talked about any of the plot of this movie, because there's not, I mean, it's the same plot as the first, if you've seen the first movie, you get it. Something evil is coming, and it's whether or not it's in Sigourney Weaver's refrigerator or at her other job, apparently.
Yeah, in her baby carriage, yeah.
Apparently, Sigourney Weaver just brings evil, that's all there is to it. It occurs in Aliens and the Ghostbusters.
Well, we've seen Alien Resurrection, so we know that she brings evil.
That's exactly right. Don't invite her on your spaceship. Don't invite her to your museum or your concerts. It's something important to understand.
Don't even date her or put on.
Although apparently, sexy Bill Murray can out seduce anything, so we need to keep that in mind.
There's a lot of memes in this movie that we're going to be sure to get out into the world here.
Thanks, Netflix.
Sexy Bill Murray. Grumpy Vigo.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. And I want Bill Murray to take pictures of me if that's how he does it, because that was so seductive.
He just improvised that whole scene, and I don't know why they didn't edit it into like a third of that.
Suck in the guts, guys, with the Ghostbusters.
No! No, please go! You!
Who's this Wiggler? He's yours, Ray. Sick him.
I have discussed
Dietrich here. Hi, how are you? Ray Stantz from the Ghostbusters.
Can
nice
I tell you what
Beautiful
I told
you
here?
We're just doing a routine spook check.
If Dr. Reckman then is not here.
Yeah, we know that, Johnny.
So why are you came?
Well, we got a report. There was a major creep in the area. We checked our list and you were right on the top. Johnny, where in the hell are you from anyway?
The Upper West Side.
Ballroom's extremely hot, Peter.
Ooh, that's one ugly dude.
Well, that's Vigo. Mr. Vigo! Viggs.
Please.
Would you look this way, please?
No,
show me something.
No!
All right, Mr. Vigo.
No photographs, please. Slides are available in the gift shop.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Winston. All right, you know what? Give me angry. Will you give me angry? You've had a bad day. You're cranky? Yeah, thank you. Good. Good. Ooh, angrier. Ooh, I'm scared. You're scaring me. Stop it. Yeah. Good. Okay, walk for me. Talk for me. Yeah. Okay, give me hot and sexy. Can you do it? Oh, you can. Oh, boy. Show me some teeth. Come on.
Well, there were three or four improv set pieces. Like the one where they were drilling in the street and they had to pretend to be, you know, Brooklyn. Yeah.
That reminded me of Trading Places, where it's like Dan Aykroyd is so good at throwing that like fast talking Chicago accent in there, and he doesn't really ever do it in the Ghostbusters. But they're pretending to be these, you know, Teamsters drilling in the street, and like, oh, all of a sudden he's really good at doing accents again. And like the end of Trading Places, all of a sudden he's really good at doing accents. This really stuck up, you know, brainy dude.
Oh, we tried to look up the black hole in the between these two movies, but I mean, Spies Like Us, they do the same thing, and it's what they do very, very well. It's
in real life.
Yeah. But apparently when you have them scripted, it becomes the most dull, like nothing happened in that first 30 minutes. It's spectacular. I like, especially with how much money clearly went into this, because it's the LucasArts and the Jim Henson Workshop making those puppets, sure. And then layering the effects, and then you have the, like, it's still a high cost movie without a script this time. Like, it's really got nothing. And the stunning part about it is the plot is cut and paste. Just to try to get through this. Because no one wants to talk about how this movie actually worked, because it's weak. But,
I mean, it's just like Zach said, it takes a long time to basically reestablish the first movie. Like, alright, we're kind of back to where we were the first time, but it's been 45 minutes. And then here's Act 3, and it's lifted right out of the first movie. I mean, it's the same thing.
What's weird was the jump between Act 1 and Act 2. I mean, Act 1 ended with the courthouse ghost busting. Then suddenly they have all their money back. They have the headquarters back. They're doing what they're doing.
And they're doing it well. And then the act break between Act 2 and 3, they're arrested for being insane and thrown into a mental institution.
Oh, let's see. First movie, they're arrested and put in jail by the EPA guy. And then, oh, all hell breaks loose. Big montage of ghosts all over the city. And then, oh, the mayor comes back in. Mr. Mayor, we gotta break the Ghostbusters out. Oh, that's exactly what happens in the second movie. And then, oh, we gotta have some big showdown with the bad guys. That's exactly what happened. It's just like they took an hour and, I don't know, 20 minutes to figure out that the first.
You're right. They ended up, like, I guess Dan Aykroyd likes shooting in prisons.
I mean, it just takes a lot from the first movie. Whether or not they thought, oh, this would have worked better in an insane asylum, because who's going to believe these guys rather than jail?
And I think they were thought that was funny, but it just felt like they were trying to copy the first movie.
Well, it was going to be another improv scene where something was going to happen. Just nothing happened.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because, again, the secondary characters are the funny ones. In the end, of course, the plot is driven on the fact that Viggo turns out to be so much more powerful than they were expecting, and Bill Murray gets to be a little Bill Murray, and gets to be a little bit cocky and a little bit sarcastic. Sigourney Weaver apparently holds the key to the universe and time and space and ghosts
and aliens.
And aliens. And at the end, the Statue of Liberty comes into play, which is the most ridiculous set piece ever. We have several scenes in which men slime each other. And then they end up floating down a river of slime, which goes nowhere. I don't know.
It goes to the museum.
It goes straight to the museum. Where Ben Stiller comes and saves the day from, oh man, how great would it be at night at the museum if the Ghostbusters show up to fix the fact that the horses were actually running around.
That would have been fantastic.
It would be terrible.
So or much better sequel ideas than what they actually came up with for a sequel.
Or even have a cameo of Bill Murray showing up and be like, do you need the Ghostbusters now?
Did you know they did that in the movie Casper? 1996's Casper, where Casper, the house is being destroyed, and Dan Aykroyd shows up and says, who are you going to call? And then they slime him, and he says, someone else. And then he walks off. That happens.
Paycheck. Oh, paycheck.
I'm going to take your word for it, because there's no chance I'm ever sitting through Casper again.
Coming soon to Myopia.
Yeah, no.
Casper, starring Bill Pullman.
Christina Ricci has the greatest forehead of them all.
She was Wednesday.
She was.
So at the end, Peter McNichol's love fest with this, painting turns into the entire Deus Ex Canvisa. in which the canvas comes to life, kind of, and then the guy walks out of the canvas without there actually needing to be a baby after all, and the whole plot falls apart at the end, I think.
Yeah, I didn't really quite... I mean, I understood he needed a body, supposedly, but like, for some reason, he came out of the painting anyway and didn't need the body. So, was the body there just for... I don't know.
What well, the body, body ended up leaving to run for governor of Minnesota. That's all I got.
Nice.
Yeah.
Real nice.
There's conspiracies in these libraries. I got nothing.
We got nothing to say about Ghostbusters 2. Like, it's amazing how much I loved this movie when I was a kid for nothing to happen during it.
Well, actually, the weird thing is this was actually the most successful comedy movie, and I think it broke, like, the three-day gross... theatrical gross record when it was released, and then that got broken a week later by Batman. But people, when it was released, they seemed to like it, but critics really didn't. And I think that opinion's really caught up with everyone else because nobody talks about Ghostbusters 2 anymore.
I think it was one of those movies that, because the first one was so successful, everybody had to go see it. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of movies like that like in the last couple of years where...
Yeah, it's
like,
usually sequels in the top 10 that get all the opening weekend records because all the hype behind them, built-in audience.
I would give this kind of a Star Wars syndrome where, you know, like, there's this, like, we have to see it. It's going to be huge, and it's just, it's disappointing. You know, it's episode one kind of thing. And now, it wasn't even that long. Oh, it was only 5 years, but if they had come out with a sequel this bad the next year, it would have been just as big because, in fact, it probably would have been bigger because the steel was still hot or the iron was still hot. This was even before the animated show. The animated show was huge. That's what I grew up watching.
The animated show was fantastic because I think they combined the elements from movie one and movie two and smoothed everything in and like fixed all the weird problems and stuff that were in the second movie because the animated series was fantastic.
Also, Egon had the greatest hair. Ever.
Am I the alone in saying that besides the first movie, the best thing ever to come out of Ghostbusters as a franchise was the Hi-C drink?
Oh, yeah. Ecto Cooler?
Ecto Cooler. Yes.
Oh, man.
That was good shit.
Oh, no, I had a pretty sweet eraser.
Yeah. I think I had more than one toy.
Can I trade you my Ecto Cooler for one of your erasers?
Oh.
This summer, coming to a supermarket near you, there's going to be a great new Hi-C flavor with an outrageous fruit taste. And what are we going to call it? Ecto-Cooler. Hi-C Ecto-Cooler. Slimer's new fruit drink. You've been warned.
Denied.
That's a two cooler eraser.
Oh man,
I can't spare him.
God, Slimer really was the breakaway star of this after the second one, especially because he was also in the animated show, just floating around.
Slimer is in the ending credits, by the way.
He is as Slimer.
Slimer in the animated series is fantastic because he helps the Ghostbusters hunt other ghosts.
Is he he's the Scooby Doo of the Ghostbusters show?
He definitely is the Scooby Doo without the Scooby snacks or the Yabba Dabba Doo. Is that the right one?
That's the
sure. Why not?
Oh, sorry, wrong one.
Zoinks.
I don't even remember anything about the animated show except scenes with Slimer. So yeah.
I remember it was
two disappointed cameos. Why was he in this movie at all? Other than you can't say, well, there was a Ghostbusters movie and Slimer wasn't in it. That's the only reason he was in this movie.
That's true.
I mean, like, maybe it was really, honestly, the first one, he adds comic relief. He's one of the first ghosts they try to get. It's ridiculous. It turns into a disaster. He's making, you know, like kind of fake animal sound effects. They thought, hey, maybe he'll lighten this movie, which is a slog fest, and it didn't do anything. Like, really, all he does is eat Rick Moranis' lunch. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Well, he also picks up Rick Moranis to take him to the ghost fighting scene.
Oh, apparently he could drive and Rick Moranis just buys it. Oh, and actually gets him there.
It's a lot of jobs in the 80s.
Yeah. I would have, like, that could have been a joke. Why didn't they just drive the bus, it floats away, and he gets dropped in the middle of the Hudson River? Like, that would have been funny.
Fit that character, too. Like, weird shit happens to him.
And he would have been like, oh man, now I have to take the subway. Like, that would have been like.
Or he gives him a hammer.
He opens
or
the door and a wall of slime hits him. Like, I would have just followed Rick Moranis that time because the Ghostbusters weren't doing crap.
With regard to Slimer, I think that he actually, especially in the first one, I sort of felt like the first one, it has a lot of really adult jokes, but I felt like it was maybe a little more kid friendly. I'm kind of, you know, this is kind of just coming to me right now, but I remember when I was growing up, it was the second one that scared me to death. Like, I wasn't terrified of the first Ghostbusters. I felt like it was a pretty, you go back and watch it now, and there are tons of adult jokes in that film, but, you know, ghosts like Slimer, they weren't really meant to scare anyone, but I was actually terrified of the Viggo character when I was a kid.
Well, that's that scene in the subway, or the old subway, where there's, like, heads
the
on
disembodied
pikes,
heads.
Just
that was
all,
my
yeah.
favorite scene in the movie, was the head on the pike seat.
Hello! Hello?
Winston.
Okay, I'm out of here.
They're gone.
What the?
Before we go any further, I think we should get our proton packs.
Good idea.
That's a horror scene.
Yeah,
it is. Scene.
Yeah, they're all scared out of
that,
their mind. There's no Bill Murray
kid,
to light
the
mood. It's like, they actually planned that. Like, if we don't have Bill Murray here, it's just going to be scientists and Ernie Hudson who's just scared of everything.
Yeah.
And it's like, that works a lot better. And that scene is actually scary.
It lands. Well, I mean, the first one, they had to temper everything. Like you said, everything's scary with something humorous, because you have Zool who's down here, like,
there is no Dana.
There is no Dana. It is only me. It is only Zool. And then it turns into the Marshmallow Man, right? Which is the most cartoonish thing around. And Dan Aykroyd has that line. In the second one, it's not. Like, because the Statue of Liberty is not adorable. It's actually really creepy, that scene, because what is it doing? It's crushing cars and presumably killing hundreds of people.
I love the crushing cars, by the way. I thought that was absolutely hysterical.
Except the effect was so bad, they didn't show the Statue of Liberty leaving footprints on the street, just crushing cars.
Yeah.
So there you go.
It's light as a feather and heavy as it wants
she
to be.
She walks light. She walks light.
Yeah.
Well, they try to make her adorable with Bill Murray asking whether she's wearing anything under that toga. So.
Well, they also wanted to put Nikes on her, but apparently they didn't make them in her size.
Because Nike paid enough to get mentioned, but not enough to be physically seen.
When I said that line, two of the people here just started shaking their heads and clasping their foreheads. So you can understand how bad that played.
Their response to it in the movie was, "She's French. What do you think?" Which was fantastic.
No, it wasn't.
It's bad when SNL people are making jokes that we predict before they're coming out of their mouth.
Yeah.
It, like, there's no creativity in these jokes.
They spend this whole little, I mean, I don't even remember how they're setting up why they need the Statue of Liberty to come to life, to come to their rescue.
Get everybody to cheer.
They need
have positive energy because New York City is so full of negative energy,
but
so you have to counter that with the opposite.
A symbol of
but the weird thing about it is
American life, and then Bill Murray's like, you know, she's French, right?
Well, Scott, there's like
we
a
just said
there's a huge plot hole with that because like what ends up destroying his power isn't the Statue of Liberty. The Statue of Liberty falls in the end, by the way, like on the street, but.
Yeah,
but what actually destroys the negativity power is the fact that it's New Year's and everybody starts cheering.
Yeah,
so
they
start
singing for no reason.
So what the hell is the point of the Statue of Liberty there except to make it like look cool or something? I don't get it.
Hey, Calzone's a Derek Jeter.
Yeah. Just start throwing out Yankee hats, everyone.
I mean, they could have just gone out and handed out free pizzas from a well-known pizzeria. I mean,
Ray's, famous original Ray's.
Oh yeah,
although
everybody would have been
Chicago,
going crazy.
Apparently,
yeah, that's true. Well, he's Dan.
It's a little weird though, because you think that the Statue of Liberty is running rampant. There are poltergeists everywhere. There's slime coming out of the sewers, but everyone's cheering. Everyone's happy. It's like none of the New Yorkers had any sense of the magnitude of what was going on at all in any of these movies. And I think that kind of comes full circle when you think, well, no one remembered even what the hell happened in the first movie, so clearly they're all just oblivious to everything.
Well, it could have been that it all came back to them. Oh, yeah, this happened before, no big deal. Like, oh, yeah, giant thing marching through the streets. Ghostbusters got this, we can get drunk. Like,
I think the real reason everybody's out cheering is because they're all lawyers, and they all know they're going to make a lot of money off either the damage or the lawsuits or whatever, you know?
I got nothing. I mean, like,
the end of this makes no sense.
There was one scene that made me laugh. It wasn't at the end, but it was close to the beginning. It was that scene where Bill Murray's going to see Dana at the art museum, and he runs into that security guard, and the security guard's like, you're one of my top two favorite shows. You're this Bassmaster. One laugh in an hour and 15-minute movie isn't a good track record.
This is 1989, and, I mean, the dude's saying Bassmaster. I mean... half the people listen, you know, there's like 14 people listening to this. Yeah. Half the people listening to this, their favorite show is Swamp People or.
Right. I mean,
they still make
Bass Callers or.
I'd like to think like that Bassmaster lives in all of us. Yeah.
Oh my God.
The hearts of all
of hearts
children.
Of children. In the hearts of children, you'll find Bassmasters.
Oh. I still think they have it. It's like on Animal Planet or something now. Yeah.
They definitely got Bassmaster.
The point.
Or something very similar to Bassmaster. Who knows what it's called?
That's what I'm saying.
Damn
25
shark?
Years ago,
shark
they're very
hunter.
Predictive. Yeah.
No, but that's three the thing networks. About the comedy in this movie is it's those quiet moments like that that really don't belong in some huge special effects laden blockbuster. It's
And that's what I think is a big problem with this movie is I couldn't tell who the audience for this movie was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Like, I couldn't tell if this was supposed to be a kid's movie, if this was supposed to be an adult movie with some stuff thrown in for kids. I couldn't tell.
I don't know if it was supposed to be a horror movie, a comedy,
yeah.
You know, a romance
romantic,
film.
Yeah.
I mean,
like
literally, that movie.
Drama. It's like trying to be everything all at once.
Well, it's
trying to please all the fans.
It does have an entire romantic comedy plotline through it. Like, it really does.
Yeah.
I mean, the only demographic they really hit are the slime fetishists, because we get some knowing looks between Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, who clearly have both had sex with the slime. That sounds like us reading into it, but that line is literally read aloud.
You didn't sleep with the slime, did you, Ray?
Yes, that's exactly the line right there.
And then when the slime starts a-bubbling, telling their secrets, they both look away in shame, because that's it's something that happened in this movie.
They also look at the slime in a later scene with this look of, like, you know, lovers or something kind of creepy like that.
Well, there's this scene late in the movie when they're both covered in slime, and they start screaming at each other, do you really want this? Come on, let me have it! And then they start taking off their clothes.
And later, it's love slime. Mm-hmm. And he wants to hug people after being thoroughly slimed.
Give me some of that positivity slime.
Mm-hmm.
I need that for my job search right now.
So I've got to ask, though, this positive, negative energy being the driving force of this movie, what is the takeaway from this movie?
Yeah, I think we should get it.
Is it that New York is a hellhole and can only survive if everyone comes together a little
bit? That was the weird thing for me is there were times it seemed like this wanted to be a serious social commentary on the state
exactly,
of New York
yeah.
in the late 80s, but ultimately just, I don't know, drop a huge, massive monument in the middle of the streets, so nobody will notice.
Well, the mayor even says, like, it's the God-given right of every New Yorker to hate everyone and be a big asshole if they want to.
I'm pretty sure that was Bloomberg's campaign statement when he was running, so.
Yep. I love New York. I'm an asshole.
Let's arrest people.
But yeah, and I think building off of that, I think it's about time for our wrap-up, because we're at 39 minutes already. Does this movie hold up in any way? And we'll come to you last because you defended this. But, Aaron?
I really wanted to root for this movie. I really did.
You did.
You know, my brothers and I still yell "Es Vigo" at each other. But I have to say that it really doesn't. And it doesn't for all the reasons that we talked about. I mean, it's like... it is a complete rehashing of the first version, but just not as good. It doesn't let Bill Murray shine, which is a pretty difficult thing to do. It just doesn't have the heart that the first one has. And and that actually really disappointed me.
Scotty boy.
This movie came out and takes place 5 years after the first one, and that alone, I mean, it feels like a money grab throughout the whole movie. It's like, we're just going to show up because our careers between then, the first one and the new one, have been, for Bill Murray, Scrooged was basically the only thing he did in between, which could be a subject of the show later on.
Yeah.
But
I'll defend that one to the
death. Not a huge movie, and not, I mean, you know, it's Bill Murray. He's got much bigger movies. And Dan Aykroyd, he did Great Outdoors, not a whole lot in between. And I think it was just like, hey, you know what? We need to make some money, get everyone's name back out there. Places, didn't it? That was before the first Ghostbusters.
Was it?
And so it was Spies Like Us, and so some things like that. And so it was, I feel like their careers didn't explode like they thought they would after the first Ghostbusters. 5 years later, they just all come back. We got to do another one. We'll make a gazillion dollars, you know, because everyone's hyped it. And maybe that'll get us back out there. Yeah.
Well, it just
it just read a lot like that to me. Like, it was lazy filmmaking, lazy writing, lazy acting, except for Rick Moranis. It was just a money grab. It's just a straight, we need to get our names on a billboard, and so we're throwing a Ghostbusters
to them. Well, and then frankly, just to add a tag to your comments, which I think are pretty good there, it's the first thing we see from the Paramount logo is a black screen that just says 5 years later. It doesn't even try. There's no in between. It's just 5 years later. Steve-O?
I think I'm going to have to break the trend here and say that I didn't remember most of this movie, and I kind of liked it to some degree. I think that there were some great scenes that worked well, and sure, if you compare it to the first one, there's obviously a disparity in quality, but I think that they still worked for what they were. There was some great sort of off-the-cuff improv humor. There were some good high-budget scenes. Like, honestly, the special effects still kind of work compared to modern movies. It was sort of creepy. It was sort of funny. I thought it was enjoyable enough to sink an hour and a half into it. So, not my favorite movie, but definitely, yeah, I would say go watch it if you've got an hour and a half free.
Daniel.
I mean, I'm going to just say, I guess, what I said at the beginning. The problem with this movie is just it makes no difference whether or not it exists. So, going off of what Steve said, it's fine to kill time with. It's certainly, there's a lot worse movies out there, but compared to the precedent set by the first one, it just doesn't really do a lot for me. That it seems like they didn't know really what they wanted to do and why they wanted to make a sequel besides money, which is a problem, and it's a problem with a lot of franchises these days. So, I don't know. I guess I'm not going to condemn it completely, but I'm just going to say you should probably just watch the first one instead if you're really interested. But if you really want to watch the second one, you can do worse.
Zeus?
So what I'm going to say is a little off the record from where everybody else went. I think the last 20 minutes as an American you have to see, because the Statue of Liberty comes alive and
9/11 happened, guys. It happened.
And that's just like, I just think that's the dream of most people that like come to this country. Like, to them,
to ride the Statue of Liberty.
Well, not even ride. Like, I mean, like my ancestors, that was the first thing they saw when they came to this country. So I think that's a huge.
Dan Aykroyd riding the Statue of Liberty.
I just think that's a huge symbol for a lot of people. Yeah. But other than that, I think the movie wasn't as good as the first one. So if you've seen the first one, then watching pretty much everything else in the second movie is not as good except for the Statue of Liberty part.
Actually, I think building off of you, I agree. Like, if you're gonna like have a bunch of people over, watch the first one, and then the second one's the one you watch the next day is The Hangover. You have a little bit of Gatorade, you wait for the Bill Murray line. Cause building off of what Steve said, there's nothing wrong with it, but the first one is so much stronger that if you're going to watch it, it needs to be in, you know, after the first one when you're just half paying attention. It's a Sunday afternoon on the couch just enjoying a nothing movie, because it's a shame, but it is a completely forgettable nothing movie.
Until you go to sleep at night, and then Vigo's gonna pop into your head, and you won't be able to sleep.
It's Vigo.
Yeah. Welcome to 9-year-old me.
Oh my god.
Don't worry, you can sleep with your eraser tonight to protect
her. That's right.
I'll give you 2 juice boxes.
Well, so in that mixed bag, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening. I've been Nick Hoffman.
Aaron.
Scott.
Steve-O.
Daniel.
Zach.
And this has been Myopia Defend Your Childhood. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think this is going to be another one of those funky ones.
Myopia Defend Your Childhood is brought to you by DudeLetter.com. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman and produced by Ann Burns. The theme song is Caroline, written and performed by The Serenaders. Purchase their newest album, Don't Ever Tell Her No, available through the Amazon link on DudeLetter.com. Questions or comments? Please visit DudeLetter.com for all your Myopia Defend Your Childhood needs, or contact us through myopia@dudeletter.com. Tonight's episode was also sponsored by Ecto Cooler. Remember when no one cared about artificial ingredients and coloring? Hi-C, nostalgic flavor, nostalgic label, and ingredient standards. Tune in next time when we'll put another little piece of your past on trial.
This L-shaped thing, and so you can spin it around like this on the top of your pencil head. Yeah, pretty epic. No,
that's the reason why. So that's the reason why you got an F in those classes.
If you've got a slime eraser like that, you don't make mistakes, my friend.
That's right.
You have made nothing but quality choices.
Myopia Movies is produced by Nick Hoffman and Daniel Settis. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman and Daniel Settis. Mission Briefing is hosted by John Copsey. Podcasts are edited by Daniel Settis, and Patreon is edited by Nick Hoffman. Our engineer is Nick Hoffman. The theme song is Surf Shimmy by Kevin MacLeod from Incomtech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license.